Mark chapter 8, 22 through 33. And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out to the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word. Tacitus, you may have heard of him, great Roman historian. He tells a story of Vespasian. And Vespasian, he was an emperor of Rome. He actually was the guy who followed Nero, and he ruled from AD 69 to AD 79. Well, Tacitus writes about him, or records, "One of the common people of Alexandria, well known for his loss of sight, threw himself before Vespasian's knees, praying to him with groans to cure his blindness. And he besought the emperor to deign to moisten his cheeks and eyes with his spittle. Vespasian at first ridiculed these appeals and treated them with scorn. But after securing advice from his friends," as Suetonius states in a parallel retelling of this, "with a smiling countenance amid intense excitement on the part of the bystanders, he did as he was asked to do. The day shone again for the blind man." Huh. Interesting that. Sound familiar? Did we just hear something about something just like that happening? I mean, didn't Jesus spit? Didn't he spit on the blind man? On his eyes? Like Vespasian is recorded to have done? Now, Vespasian's story of his cure for the blind man, now this is not exactly an unusual story from ancient times. There are numerous ancient stories that entail the spit of a remarkably virtuous or powerful person having healing powers, even to restore sight. Indeed, Jesus' motions of spitting and rubbing it on the eyes of the blind man so that he might see were right in line with the magical techniques known during the first century. So, with such tales circulating, the question was raised, and is still raised, do Jesus' miracles of healing fall into the category of magic? Was he using magical, thaumaturgical techniques to do what he did? Now, many have made exactly such a claim against Jesus. Justin Martyr wrote, and it's on the front of your bulletin there, "This Christ healed those who were maimed and deaf and lame in body from their birth, causing them to leap, to hear, and to see by his word. And having raised the dead and causing them to live, by his deeds he compelled the men who lived at that time to recognize him. But though they saw such works, they asserted it was a magical art, for they dared to call him a magician and a deceiver of the people. The problem with such a view is that it does not recognize who Jesus is. It presents a human-centric view of his identity and his work, misconceptions that lead to wrong conclusions. And misconceptions about Jesus are an old and an ongoing story, even as his disciples today. We have a tendency to see things in a human-centered way versus a God-centered way. And such misconceptions leave us with a partial blindness, a partial understanding as to the full implications of who Jesus truly is and as to Christ's work in our lives and in the world around us. In the events of Mark 8, 22 through 33 here, they address such misconceptions and they point us to a proper focus so that we might see with understanding. And while these events take place in geographically different places and have very different activities occurring in them, they both provide a twofold demonstration as to Jesus' statement in verse 33. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. And we, in these accounts, we learn that our perception of Jesus' work must be in line with the reality that he does what he wants to do according to his purposes and will, and not according to our preconceptions and our will. We also learn our perceptions of Jesus' identity, who he is, needs to be consistent with how he reveals himself to us in his word, the true Christ, and resist cultural impressions that frankly muddy our perceptions and invent a false Christ. So take a look again with me at verse 22. And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. So what is going on here? The people of Bethsaida who brought the blind man, well, they came to Jesus with some preconceptions as to who he was and what he could do. They had heard or they had witnessed his previous actions of healing. And perhaps they even heard a retelling of what he did when he healed the deaf mute. If you remember, that's in chapter 7, verses 31 through 37. And that healing, you remember, involved Jesus healing the man with a word, ephphatha. And yet evidently, the sign language Jesus used to communicate with this deaf man, which involved touching and spitting, was misinterpreted by some as a magical technique. And hence they brought the man to Jesus, thinking that he was a healing magician, and they expected Jesus to heal according to magical techniques, techniques designed to manipulate the divine to the service of man, the things of man. And Jesus, to make his point as to their confusion, chose to proceed to operate according to their misconceptions. So look at 23 and 24. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking." Notice how when Jesus did things according to man's idea, using thaumaturgical, isn't that a word? Look at that. Thaumaturgical techniques involving the spitting on the man's eyes and laying his hands on him, that the results were less than satisfactory. Jesus, having made his point by doing the things the way they expected him to do it, well, then he does it his way. So look at verse 25. Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, And he opened his eyes, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Now, healing a blind man with touch finds no parallel in any pre-Christian records. I mean, he followed no understood pattern of actions to manipulate the divine will to man's will. Jesus' touch was unique. Jesus demonstrated that man's mistaken expectations and misconceptions concerning his identity and his work do not lead to his perfect work. His actions in this encounter challenged the people's misconceptions and worked to correct their confusion. He challenged them to reconsider who he is. And Jesus needed no manipulative, magical techniques to bend the will of the divine to his will. He was, and he is, divine. His will was, and is, in accord with the Father's will, and his will creates reality. Specifically in this account, his will created the reality of the blind man's sight while choosing to use a mere touch. So we see that the divine will not be manipulated by man's desires. You know, he answers our prayerful pleas according to his will in the way he chooses to do it. In other words, God does as he wills in the way that he wills, so accomplishing his perfect work. Our way, well, it just wouldn't get it done. And because Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we must see his work as being according to his will and not ours. In the encounter with the people in Bethsaida and the blind man and numerous previous instances, such as his conflicts, Jesus' conflicts with the Pharisees, make it clear that in the face of Jesus' actions, the people kept coming up with the wrong conclusions as to who he was. There was just too much ambiguity there. Thus, Mark naturally transitions from the misconceptions of the people of Bethsaida to a conversation that Jesus had with his disciples about his identity. So look at 27 through 30. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. Now, having challenged the people of Bethsaida to reconsider who he is, Jesus then follows up that with this question to his disciples as they walked along by asking, "Who do the people say that I am?" And clearly, John the Baptist, Elijah, or one of the prophets, well, those are the wrong answers. So what was the problem? Why were so many people coming to the wrong conclusion? Well, it seems that the problem starts with their beginning their inquiry with the wrong question. They were working from the question of how. Working from the question of how. How are such mighty works done by his hands? That's what they asked in Mark 6:2. In other words, how does he cast out demons? How does he heal all sorts of diseases? How did he come by such wisdom to teach in such an authoritative way? And in light of these incorrect popular musings, Jesus asked, Who do you say that I am? And that is really the question, isn't it? That's the question. Jesus hits on the preeminent Christological question, the question of who. And this is the first question. And it, well, from it flows all of the answers. And when I say all of the answers, I really mean all of them. All the answers to every question of science, every question of philosophy, every question of psychology, every question of religion, every question man can come up with concerning his observations of reality. God's work. It is, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer states in his book, Christ the Center, Christology is the center of all disciplines. It is the unknown and hidden center of the university of learning. What it boils down to is that the answer to who is found, the foundation of all knowledge, all reality. I'll say that again. The answer to who is the foundation of all knowledge, all reality. Now, you may remember that the disciples had, well, they had asked this question when Jesus calmed the storm back in Mark 4, verse 41. Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? They asked, who? And that was the right question. And it must have been rattling around in their brains as they went along with Jesus, and Jesus continued to do these signs and these wonders. Thus, Jesus was not asking a trivial question of his disciples. This question was one, too, that the disciples had been contemplating for some time. And so Peter speaks up. You are the Christ. And Peter gets it right. But then he gets it wrong at the same time. His confession that Jesus is the Christ, which Christ is the Greek form of the word, or the title rather, Messiah. Well, this confession was correct. However, his understanding of what that meant was wrong. He had lapsed back into the question of how, losing focus on the question of who. And we know this because of what comes next. 31 through the first part of 32 there. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. Now here, Jesus was telling his disciples how it had to be for him, the Son of Man, the Christ, to do his work in a perfect way. And Jesus was filling in the answer of who with the substance of his work according to God's will. But Peter, well, the second part of verse 32 here, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, if you can imagine. Peter answers the question of who in form, but not in substance. Not in substance. So therefore he got it wrong. Peter's misconceptions about the Christ has no room in it whatsoever for a suffering Messiah. His answer to how was according to popular messianic expectations of the time, the things of man. And it was not informed by the who, as Jesus laid it out, which is the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. The things of God. Even more, it is as Carolyn Ayayo posits, inasmuch as Peter's claim that Jesus was the Messiah carried with it widely held Jewish beliefs about how Jesus would restore the kingdom and overturn Rome and had no room for a suffering Messiah, then Peter's answer in 8:29 is equally identified as a method that at its core intends to manipulate and impose on the divine will. And Peter had fallen into the trap that the people at Bethsaida, who took the blind man to Jesus for healing, had fallen into. His misconceptions about the Christ clouded his vision. Jesus' identity can never, ever be separated from His work. The two make up the complete Jesus of history. And further, as Bonhoeffer puts it, He is the one who is His own work. The Scriptures reveal this very high Christological view in the Colossian hymn, Colossians 1, 15 through 20. And in this beautiful passage, Paul shows us the preeminence of Christ in everything. He proclaims that by Him and through Him, all things were created, and that all things were created for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. All reality, it holds together by His very existence. All reality gains its substance from His being, and this is all tied in with His work, which, as Paul puts it, includes making peace by the blood of His cross. And Jesus was not here to fulfill the expectations based on man's misunderstandings. He was here to do His Father's will, as the suffering servant prophesied by Isaiah, dying on the cross and being resurrected. Hence Jesus' rebuke of Peter in verse 33. "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And to see who Jesus truly is requires a mind set on the things of God. And this is a way of seeing that only God can provide. Matthew 16, 17. When we possess this sight, we are able to understand who Jesus is. And from that point come to see and to understand His work. And how can we receive such sight? And the way we come to truly see and understand the things of Christ comes through Christ's touch. Through Christ's touch. And we receive that touch by submitting to the will of God through faith. And there's a lot of misconceptions out there about Jesus. A lot of them. And R.C. Sproul, in his book, Who is Jesus?, lays it out. This is what Dr. Sproul said. "There are so many portraits of Jesus in the galleries of this world that it seems hopeless to clarify the confusion they have wrought in people's minds about who Christ is. So many conflicting images of Him are put forward that some people have despaired of achieving an accurate picture to His true identity. His portrait has been altered to suit the fancy of those seeking to line Him up on their side, to make Him an ally in a host of militant causes, many of which are mutually exclusive. Rigorous academic attempts have been made to get behind the New Testament portrait of Jesus, to discover the real historical Jesus. What scholars discovered behind the veil was a mirror of their own prejudice and a Jesus created in their own images. The 19th century liberals found a liberal Jesus. The existentialists found an existential hero. And the Marxists discovered a political revolutionary. Idealists found an idealistic Jesus. And pragmatists discovered a pragmatic Jesus Christ." Now, many further examples can be given. Actually, I recommend that book. It's a good book to read. It's called Who is Jesus? That should be easy to remember. R.C. Sproul, Who is Jesus? It's a really good, it's a little short book, but it's a really good read. But like I said, many further examples can be given. And they all show that man keeps trying to mold Christ in their own image and claim that their image is the true Christ. And the problem is that to distort the true Christ is to set up a false Christ. And as Sproul puts it, the Christ we believe, the Christ we trust, must be true if we are to be redeemed. A false Christ or substitute Christ cannot redeem. Who do you say that Jesus is? Think about Jesus. And think about what you know about Jesus. Think about, you know, what impressions that you have about Him. Ask yourself, where do my knowledge and my impressions of Jesus come from? In many cases, and particularly among regular church-going Christians, there is a blend. I mean, much comes from learning about Jesus in Sunday school, in sermons, in Bible studies, in personal readings, which hopefully is right on target, but really, that kind of depends on what church you're going to. Yeah. And so often, there's a mix in our minds thrown at us that comes from the culture. And we kind of absorb that into our minds. It kind of warps our understanding a little bit. For some folks, more, and for some folks, less. And then there's the case of the unchurched, those who don't know the Scriptures, whether they claim to be Christians or not. Their knowledge of Christ, if any, is rarely even close to accurate. It is so warped by the culture. Yet I suggest that, well, never, really, does anyone have 100% accurate view of who Jesus is in this life. Now, we won't have that perfect understanding until glory. Paul tells us this in 1 Corinthians 13:12. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. Our sin, our ignorance of the Scriptures, our lapses in faith, and our limited capacity keep us from comprehending the full scope of who Jesus truly is and His work in the world, in our lives. I mean, we will never see Him perfectly until glory. But be not dismayed at this. Be not dismayed. The Scriptures tell us truly who Jesus is. And it tells us truly about His work. The Scriptures give us enough. They are sufficient. And through God's Word and the power of the Holy Spirit, we come to see the true Christ. We come to know the true Christ. And we do this through faith. Because Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we must see Him as He reveals Himself to us. Study the Scriptures. Study the Scriptures if you're not doing so. Study them on your own. Study the Scriptures. If you're a Christian, you need to be studying the Scriptures. I think y'all got that now. Study the Scriptures. Pursue the true Christ as He is revealed in them, His identity and His work. Have your mind set on the things of God. Ask the question, who? And consider the Lord's revealed will and work in light of who He is. Submit yourself to His will, and you will find Him, the preeminent one, and you will see Him in truth as He reveals Himself to you. And because Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we must see Him as the center of all things.